Headlines around the world today. Tropical cyclone Eloise made landfall in Mozambique early on Saturday, hitting the coastal city of Beira with huge gusts of winds and heavy rains. But it was losing strength as it progressed, according to a South African weather official. Portuguese voters who are largely confined to their homes due to a strict COVID-19 lockdown will pick a new president on Sunday. But many fear going to the polls could worsen a surge in coronavirus cases, and low turnout is expected. The country of 10 million people, which fared better than others in the first wave of the pandemic, now has the world's highest 7-day rolling average of new cases and deaths per million people. 3 people in hotel quarantine associated with the Australian Open tennis tournament have tested positive for the highly transmissible coronavirus variant linked to the United Kingdom. That's what officials are saying on Saturday. The 3 quarantined in Melbourne are not tennis players, said the state agency responsible for quarantining travelers. All have been in hard lockdown since their January 15th arrival. Saudi Arabia's foreign minister said on Saturday the kingdom was optimistic that it would have an excellent relationship with the new U.S. administration of President Joe Biden and that it would continue to negotiate with Washington regarding the Iran nuclear deal. France's top health advisory on Saturday recommended doubling the time between people being given the first and second COVID-19 vaccinations to 6 weeks from 3 in order to increase the number of those getting inoculated. For more on these stories, visit voanews.com. This is VOA News. Police detained over 1,500 people and used force to break up rallies around Russia on Saturday as tens of thousands of protesters demanded the release of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny, whose wife was among those detained. Navalny had called on his supporters to protest after being arrested last weekend as he returned to Russia from Germany for the first time since being poisoned with a nerve agent he says was applied to his pants by state security agents in August. The authorities had warned people to stay away from Saturday's protests, saying they risk catching COVID-19 as well as prosecution and possible jail time for attending an unauthorized event. But protesters defied the ban and bitter cold and turned out in force. In central Moscow, where Reuters reported estimated at least 40,000 people had gathered in one of the biggest unauthorized rallies for years, police were seen roughly detaining people, bundling them into nearby vans as well. A protest monitoring group said that at least 1,600 people, including 513 in Moscow and over 200 in St. Petersburg, had been detained across Russia. It reported arrests at rallies in nearly 70 towns and cities. Navalny is a 44-year-old lawyer, and he is in a Moscow prison now, pending the outcome of 4 legal matters he describes as trumped up. He accuses President Vladimir Putin of ordering his attempted murder. Putin has dismissed that, alleging Navalny is part of a U.S.-backed dirty tricks campaign to discredit him. In a push to galvanize support ahead of the protest, Navalny's team released a video this week about an opulent palace on the Black Sea they allege belonged to Putin, something the Kremlin denied. As of Saturday, the clip had been viewed more than 68 million times. 8 Chinese bomber planes and 4 fighter jets entered the southwestern corner of Taiwan's air defense identification zone on Saturday, and Taiwan's Air Force deployed missiles to monitor the incursion, the island's defense ministry said. China, which claims Taiwan as its own territory, has conducted almost daily flights over the waters between the southern part of Taiwan and the Taiwan-controlled Pratas Islands in the South China Sea in recent months. For more on these stories making international news headlines, we'd like to invite you to visit our website. That's voanews.com. You can also download our mobile app to your device. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News. Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, Richard Lautendress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada, and our moderator is Dan Revive, columnist for Newsday.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. A new leader here in America, Joseph R. Biden Jr., is now the president of the United States. Donald J. Trump has returned to being a private citizen at his resort and private club in Palm Beach, Florida. Also, Mr. Biden's Democratic Party has captured just barely majority control in the U.S. Senate, and the Democrats already had the majority in the House of Representatives. What do these big changes mean for the months and years ahead? First, let's go back to this past Wednesday. Every 4 years, on January 20th, a president of the United States is sworn in. Joe Biden took the oath of office, pledging to work hard to unite Americans in a country that is politically deeply divided. But some of Mr. Biden's first policy moves are already being condemned by leading Republicans. Mr. Biden, they say, is simply being a liberal or progressive, bringing back Barack Obama's policies, as well as many Obama staffers returning to the U.S. government. Tom DeFrank, first, please speak about Inauguration Day with the tightest security we'd ever seen here in Washington, D.C. 25,000 National Guard soldiers plus thousands of police were on duty. Tom, how did things go?
Well, they went surprisingly well. There was no massive influx of insurrectionists, as some have called them, as peaceful protesters, as they like to call themselves. It reminds me of the Green Zone in Baghdad. At one point, a huge swath of downtown was shut down. 18 subway system stations were closed. The bridges were closed coming into Washington. It would have been very difficult for anybody to make mischief. And thankfully, there was none. I mean, now somebody will surely say maybe it was overkill. But after the events of January 6th, where thousands of people got into the Capitol, the temple of American democracy, and trashed a good part of it, the government wasn't going to take any chances. So far, so good. The inauguration went off without a hitch, Dan.
Tom, it was a relief that there wasn't any violence here in Washington on Inauguration Day itself. And at the ceremony, the former president, the outgoing president, Donald Trump, he wasn't there. A big break in tradition. That hadn't happened for more than 150 years that an outgoing president refused to come to the ceremony that was swearing in his successor. But there were three former presidents there, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and a Republican, George W. Bush. So there was that symbol of unity. Richard Lautendress, as a foreign correspondent here, a Canadian who knows the United States very well, when you put all of that together, no violence, yes, Republicans were there, but not Donald Trump. What did you think about Inauguration Day on the 20th?
Well, it looked and it felt as normal as can be. Tom was underlining the fact that the city was under siege, was the National Guards, thousands of them around, policemen, women. But there's also the reality of the pandemic. We could not bring people in the city. The new administration didn't want people to agglomerate on the mall and be side by side. So it was creating a new reality, a very different reality compared to what we saw during the previous inauguration days when, you know, there was fervor and there was enthusiasm. And I remember well Barack Obama's swearing-in ceremonies. There were people, even people who did not support the new president, who were in town willing to indulge in this new spirit coming with this new administration. This time it was impossible to fill this. And still, I had the impression that walking around, the way Joe Biden went, for instance, to mass early in the morning with congressional leaders, he was sworn in normally as 45 presidents before him. The visit to Arlington Cemetery was solemn but normal. You know, there's a platform that was built just on the other side of Pennsylvania Avenue and Lafayette Square in front of the White House. I have seen Donald Trump and Barack Obama walk in front of us. But in the end, you know, there were military bands and police corps and a band from the University of Delaware, and the President Biden walked in front of us without a crowd, but as normal as can be. So all this to say, to me, they succeeded to organize something with the threat that was in the city after what happened 2 weeks ago and the reality of the pandemic, and it worked out pretty well. That's the impression it left me.
A lot of relief here in Washington that January 20th has come and gone without major upheaval or violence. And yet, you're right, you have the sense that because of COVID-19, that there were never going to be many members of the public involved, but especially after January 6th. As Tom has reminded us, pro-Trump protesters invaded the Capitol building. They tried to stop Congress from confirming the election results. At least 5 deaths were caused by that. And 2 weeks later, in exactly the same location, just outside the Capitol building and inside the building as well, everything was normal and calm. So that was a major relief. But Tom, the anger that we saw on January 6th, it seems to me that a lot of the rumors and misinformation and mistrust still exists in America. Opinion polls indicate that tens of millions of Americans don't think that the election was fair and legitimate. That's not gone, is it, Tom?
No, it's not gone at all, Dan. About a third of the country has questions about the election's legitimacy, but more to the point, more than two-thirds of voters who supported Mr. Trump think the election was rigged and agree with him that it was stolen. That is a breathtaking number. It's ridiculous. It's absurd. But when you have that many Americans believing it, that tells you we have a long way to go here in terms of calming the tones of bringing the country together. Now, President Biden said in his inaugural speech, democracy has prevailed. And I think he was right about that. But bipartisanship is a long way from being a reality. With that many millions of people believing the former president's spurious allegations, there's a lot of polarization and a lot of anger out there. And as long as Republicans don't step up to the plate and say, we have to say this, these claims of a rigged election are bogus. Until Republicans start doing that, I don't think there's any chance to fix the polarization, the extreme polarization in the country.
Richard, as you were covering the start of the new Biden administration on January 20th, what stood out to you? Because I know a lot of correspondents were underlining the vice president, right? The new vice president, Kamala Harris, until recently a senator from the state of California. She's the first female vice president. She's the first person of color, as some people put it, of both African-American heritage and South Asian heritage. There were celebrations in her mother's ancestral town in India. And so Kamala Harris represents a lot, but I think she wanted to show that her focus is getting to work.
Yes, the focus of the vice president is to show that the country can fall on its feet and start running early in a new direction. And you were asking me how it was perceived, for instance, in Canada. We underlined the president's speech, this way of introducing and insisting on the fact that the Americans have for the first time a female, a woman as vice president of the United States. And he added, don't tell me this country cannot change. Things cannot change. And the perception in Canada, but I think in several other countries, was that during and after the 4 years of the Trump presidency, there was this impression that, okay, we know how this president is dealing, is managing his thing, a lot of improvisation. It's very hard to figure out how he will manage this issue one day and the day after. Now, things can change in a way that we understand and we can forecast. And I believe this is the way Kamala Harris was seen, but also, by extension, the new orders that are coming, the executive orders signed by President Biden, give us a clearer sense that, okay, what we lived, what we went through during the last 4 years, it's a totally different dynamic, which brings us somewhere else. In Canada, Dan, we, for instance, talking about those executive orders, there was disappointment when we heard that the Keystone Project was abandoned. The Keystone XL Project, which was supposed to bring oil from the tar sands fields in central Canada to the Gulf of Mexico. This said, as much as Prime Minister Justin Trudeau underlined this, he was enthusiastic with this idea of, for instance, rejoining the Climate Paris Accord, rejoining the World Health Organization, the moratorium on oil and natural gas in the Arctic. You know, there are several issues there which in the spirit of seeing Kamala Harris arriving at the vice presidency, shows that there's something new coming to the United States and to the world with this administration.
Something new and something old all along. That is a return to conventional pre-Trump policies in many ways. We'll be talking more about global reaction a little later, but let's just consider COVID-19 and how the crisis, in fact, is worse than it was in the spring of last year, including here in the U.S. Instead of last year's average of fewer than 2,000 deaths from COVID every day, it's now more than 4,000 people dying of coronavirus each day in this country. And the problems with delivering vaccines are embarrassing. Tom DeFrank, what do you see?
Well, I couldn't agree more, Dan. And there are now stories, and quoting Biden officials, as saying, we have discovered there is no real distribution plan for the vaccine, and there's not enough of it out there. So one of the first executive orders Biden has signed is to enable, under the Defense Production Act, increase and expand production of the vaccine and distribution and delivery of the vaccine. The Trump regime basically said, all right, we have created a vaccine in record time, and distributing it is your problem, not our problem. Well, the Biden people have said, no, it's everybody's problem, and we have to have a more centralized, coordinated plan. So Biden is still hoping that he can get 100 million people vaccinated in the first 100 days of his presidency, which would be roughly the 1st of May. We'll see whether he can do that. But the Biden people are saying the Trump administration talked a lot but didn't do enough. And of course, Biden has ordered the mandatory wearing of masks on all federal property. It can't be mandatory other places. The one of the dirty little not so secret secrets is that millions of Americans are spurning masks, and it's become a political issue. Basically, if you're for Trump, you think masks are a plot or a hoax or something. We have now passed the 400,000 deaths milestone, a dubious milestone indeed, and there are now computer models that say we may lose another 100,000 Americans in the next couple of months unless we do something about masks. So it's really getting worse, not getting better. And it's one of many problems that Biden has to address right away.
More on the coronavirus crisis and worldwide reaction to the change in leadership here in the United States when we continue after this brief break.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Richard Lautendress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada. And our moderator, Dan Rabib, columnist for Newsday.
Richard, we were just talking about the way the United States is handling the COVID-19 crisis, where things are getting worse. And we hear even from big cities, and maybe especially big cities like New York and Los Angeles, that they are running out of vaccine. There are days in which citizens have an appointment to get their vaccine shot, and then they show up and, I'm sorry, we've run out of vaccine. What are the facts? I mean, how can it be that the manufacturers are not keeping up with demand?
Well, obviously, there's a part of the entire process of distributing this vaccine that's not clear. There were agreements that were signed, and we had the impression from long ago, several months ago, that it was clear as soon as the vaccines were going to be approved, that they were going to be easily accessible, easily or quite easily distributed, and it's not that clear. But it brings, unfortunately, Dan, it brings me back to the before the Biden administration, in the way the whole thing was managed, the will of going fundamentally through states to manage this distribution of vaccine makes it very hard to figure out where do they come from, where do they go, who's going to have them first. And this is why I see, even without criticizing the Trump administration again, the simple fact that this new administration, it really makes a priority of fighting the coronavirus. When I was listening to the very first briefing of the new press secretary, Jen Psaki, when she said that Wednesday evening, the day of the inauguration, that the president wants us to lead by example, us being the members of the new White House, this idea that if the Trump administration had shown the same will to lead by example, to show the world that wearing a mask, being organized, is going to get us to results, that would help. So what I mean by this is that there's a signal sent by this new administration that we are going to make sure that every step is going to be built and followed closely. So first, wear mask, keep distance. Okay, now the vaccine. Where are the vaccines? How many do we have? Who gets them? And how is it distributed? There's a will to boost the supply chains, to increase the testing capacities. There's this 100 days masking challenge. So clear moment, clear repère, as we say in French, criteria that have to be respected. And I have the impression that to answer your question after this long introduction, we start from not enough information to clear benchmarks that will have to be respected. And then we will have to figure out, okay, why didn't it happen this time?
Tom, you're an expert, of course, on American government. And I think we have to point out that during a time of transition, the Biden administration doesn't begin with its Secretary of Health and Human Services. There is no clear permanent leadership in many agencies of the U.S. government. And this could hamper a national response to COVID-19 and getting enough vaccines out there.
At the moment, the only cabinet officer confirmed by the U.S. Senate is the Director of National Intelligence. Every other cabinet-level agency is being administered by an acting secretary or an acting administrator. And I think this is because the Republicans have not scheduled appointments for them. Now, I suspect within a week that will change, but at the moment, the orderly transition of power to the agencies has gone slowly. And you're correct. That will slow down the new Biden policies on vaccine dissemination and distribution.
You know, at least when it comes to newspaper editorials around the world, you know, I got the sense, especially I would say in Western Europe, also political leaders and what they had to say. Well, they seem relieved that the 4 years of Donald Trump as president are over, as though having President Joe Biden, a former vice president who was a U.S. senator for more than 30 years, will signal a return to conventional American policies. Some are saying a return to normal. Certainly, the Donald Trump policy of America first is not the Biden policy. Richard, what have you noticed about global reaction?
Global reaction, I've noticed, is one of now we can predict what is coming. We can predict because President Biden has been vice president. When he was a senator, he was chairing the Senate Committee on Foreign Affairs. They've seen him. They know the way he sees the world. He knows the world. It was interesting to read the very last interview of former State Secretary Rex Tillerson about foreign policy, about Donald Trump, underlining the fact that he didn't know the world. He didn't understand the world. Well, Joe Biden knows the world. He knows several of the leaders who are in place at the moment. Then there's Antony Blinken, is nominee for state secretary. He's been close to the president for a long time when he was senator, but he knows the State Department. He knows the world. So the reaction outside of the United States is finally a predictable team. We don't think in Canada that the concept of America first is totally going to disappear, because we know that Joe Biden insists on the buying American, and he repeated it himself, saying, you know, built in America, sold in America, and everything you want to put perspective on the fact that it's going to be an American-centered policy, but with an openness to the world that was not perceived positively in the previous administration, and this simple impression of predictability and of willingness to work on the world stage with the United Nations, with the international organizations, is perceived very positive.
Right from the start, both Wednesday and Thursday, the Biden White House said that the United States will re-enter the Paris Climate Change Accord and will cancel the Trump plan to leave the World Health Organization. The Biden administration will work with the WHO on vaccines all around the world and on trying to fight coronavirus and other diseases. So there may be a measure of relief around the world, but Saudi Arabia may stand out as an exception. The Saudis enjoyed their relations with President Trump. He would emphasize all the American weapons and military aircraft that the U.S. was selling to Saudi Arabia and other Gulf Arab countries. Those countries are waging a war against the Houthi rebels in Yemen. Saudi Arabia claims that the Houthis are basically proxies for Iran, and Donald Trump agreed with that. The Biden administration may have doubts. And on China, well, Donald Trump had turned against China this past year, saying that coronavirus is the China virus. And so he was tough on China when it comes to trade. And also in recent weeks, the Trump administration was condemning human rights abuses in China, something that it had not done. Tom DeFrank, do you have any sense that the Biden administration will be tough on Saudi Arabia and China when it comes to human rights? And that may affect America's place in the world.
Yes, I think that's going to exactly be the case. The Biden administration will be tougher on Saudi Arabia and China on human rights and civil rights. And I think the Chinese will howl about it, and the Saudis will be unhappy about it, but they're going to have to get used to that. That will happen. I wanted to add very quickly to something we've not talked about, Dan, about the changes in Washington. The biggest change, I think, is the tone of governance. Yes, we were a polarized, divided country, but we don't have Donald Trump on Twitter referring to his enemies as losers or jerks or dopes or low IQ. The pejorative nature of the Trump White House and the Trump government has gone away. That doesn't mean it's all smooth sailing. It doesn't mean the Democrats and the Republicans are going to agree on policies going forward. But in terms of just tonalities, there's a better, and I would argue more productive and constructive tone of discourse and dialogue all of a sudden. And we haven't had that in 4 years.
And just to button up our broadcast, Richard, what's your sense of that? Because the Biden administration says it wants the United States to be more united. Unity was one of the very big words for Joe Biden on the day he was inaugurated. What do you think is the outlook? A lot of doubts about uniting this country?
Doubts for sure. There's no magic wand that would improve quickly the state of affairs between Americans. But I believe that Biden's success in controlling the pandemic, of breaking this virus and the spread of the virus and the impression that we're still living away from each other without being able to have a normal life. The success of the new administration on this very point, and add to this, success of restarting the economy, helping businesses, smaller businesses in particular, to go back to something that looks like normal, welcoming customers. Again, the two go side by side. The idea of controlling the virus and improving slowly the economy and the economic activities, this success will bring more unity, more willingness from the opponent to the arrival of Joe Biden going forward and saying, okay, we see the outcome, we see the result, we see that it works out. Why not give this president a chance? Which was what Joe Biden insisted, and I think this is a major thing. Give me a chance. Listen to me. Let's see how we can do it together. And I believe with some results on these at this level, it will help this unity expectation.
Literally in his first speech as president, Joe Biden did ask Americans to give him a chance. That's all the time we have for this broadcast. Thanks to our panelists, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and Richard Latendresse, correspondent for TVA or TVA Nouvelle in Canada. This program is produced by The Voice of America. I'm Dan Ravitch.
VOA, the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Hello, and welcome to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. It's been a little over a year since the World Health Organization was first notified of cases of pneumonia in Wuhan City, China, due to what was then an unknown cause. Scientists soon learned that the infecting agent was a novel or new and unknown virus that became known as SARS coronavirus 2. The disease associated with the novel coronavirus was named COVID-19. The severity of the disease ranges from having no or very mild symptoms to those who develop much more severe respiratory symptoms and other complications that have resulted in death. According to the Coronavirus Resource Center at the Johns Hopkins University of Medicine, so far there have been more than 96 million cases of COVID-19 and over 2 million deaths globally that have been attributed to the novel coronavirus. COVID-19 has touched virtually every aspect of daily life. National, regional, and local government leaders have put unprecedented policies into effect to help mitigate the spread of COVID-19. The pandemic continues to affect the global economy, with the world's financial markets experiencing extreme volatility and uncertainty. As a result, a significant number of businesses have already closed and many more could close soon. With the pandemic's severe impact on business, many people have either lost or will lose their jobs. Schools have been forced to develop and enact remote distance learning measures so that students can continue their education. The number of COVID-19 cases and deaths throughout the pandemic has peaked and dipped. However, daily cases and deaths have been steadily and significantly rising since this past autumn. As people are bombarded each day with bad news due to COVID-19, a ray of hope signaling a possible end to the pandemic is being made with the recent release and distribution of several vaccines. Public health officials and medical researchers initially forecast that it would be at least a year and a half to several years before any COVID-19 vaccine would be made available to the public. But following urgent public and private efforts and large investments in research, several vaccines were developed and approved for widespread public vaccination campaigns. Other vaccines are still in development and may become available in the coming weeks and months. So today, we'll get an update on the COVID-19 pandemic, talk about how health professionals are handling the crisis, and learn about the available and developing coronavirus vaccines that may lead to an end to this deadly scourge. My guest who joins me by Microsoft Teams is Dr. Lisa Miragakis, MD. Dr. Miragakis is the Senior Director of Infection Prevention with the Johns Hopkins Health System and an Associate Professor of Medicine at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Miragakis, we're about 2 months away from the first anniversary of the WHO-declared COVID-19 pandemic. Did you expect the outbreak to be as widespread and severe as it's become?
You know, I think it would have been impossible to predict the magnitude of the COVID-19 pandemic when it first began. There were initially a lot of discussions about the mortality rate and whether it was high enough to cause a significant degree of harm. But of course, now in hindsight, it's very clear that this virus has a unique set of characteristics, the ability to spread among people without causing symptoms. And ironically, its mortality rate being around 1% instead of much higher, as other viruses might have, actually allows it to spread far and wide, as we have seen, and to cause very large magnitude disaster that we are still contending with today.
Dr. Miragakis, can you please share with us your thoughts on the pandemic at its beginning through where we are today? What have you learned throughout this past year?
Well, it has been such a challenging year for people around the world for so many reasons. We have learned about this virus at an unprecedented rate. So I think we can be very grateful to the scientists the world over who have collaborated and worked at record speeds to discover very basic information about the virus, how it's transmitted, and to develop therapeutics and vaccines. So that is the good side of things. But of course, many, many challenges remain, and we are really in a race with this virus. As we know, viruses like this continue to mutate, for example. And so much of the discussion now is around some of the mutations that have emerged, some of the variant strains, and we are really in a race to disseminate, distribute vaccines, and to try to protect the world population before we face even more challenges.
Dr. Mirogakis, speaking of mutated versions of the SARS-2 coronavirus, one mutation that seems to be spreading is a more infectious strain some call the UK variation. And now I'm hearing about another variation coming from California. Can you tell me what this is and how it was detected and why it spreads much more easily than the pre-mutated version?
Well, we continue to learn more about these different variants, but essentially, what we're talking about are versions of the virus that have mutated, which is a normal process as the virus makes copies of itself. Small mistakes are made, and some of them turn out to be advantageous to the virus in order to escape immune detection, or in this case, to be transmitted more easily. It seems that the individuals with the UK strain, for instance, have higher amounts of virus in their upper airways, which makes it more transmissible to other people who are around them. And so once this mutation emerged among the viruses in the UK, within a very short period of time, on the order of 2 to 3 months, it became the predominant variant that was being transmitted among people in the UK. The mutations we're talking about alter the part of the virus that is detected by our immune system that's called the spike protein. Mm-hmm. And in particular, a region of that protein that is like the lock and key that lets the virus enter human cells. And that's why we are quite concerned that we get everyone vaccinated and also control transmission through the very basic infection prevention measures of masking and physical distancing so that we limit the ability of more mutations to emerge.
Speaking of the UK variation, again, it's been known to spread much more easier than other strains of the virus. Is it just as serious as the original strain that started out about a year ago? And does it have the symptoms? Are they more serious or less serious?
So far, these variants don't appear to be more serious in terms of the types of symptoms that they cause or the severity of illness or risk of death. And so that is good news. We are grateful that these changes haven't apparently yet caused more severe disease. So the main advantage that the virus seems to have in this case is to be more easily transmitted because of that higher viral load or amount that's in the upper airways.
Dr. Mirogakis, looking at the charts of infections, deaths over the past year, I've seen peaks and dips in the number of people contracting COVID-19 each day over the past year. Can you explain why recent statistics, at least here in the U.S., seem to indicate that the number of new cases has doubled or almost tripled that of earlier higher peaks?
It's one of the most frustrating things, watching the pandemic unfold, to see it attack new geographic areas. One of the things that we are seeing in the United States that has caused the fall numbers to be so dramatically higher than in the spring is that the geographic spread is much greater this time in the second part of the surge than it was in the first surge, where it was more concentrated in New York and more limited geographic areas. So that's one reason. But I think another reason is really related to what we know about respiratory viruses, that they do typically increase in the fall and winter months when the weather is colder and drier and people gather indoors and are in closer contact with each other. And we also have had a series of holidays that we saw a lot of people gathering to celebrate and traveling. So all of these factors come together. And right now, in the United States, at least, it has really led to an overwhelming surge.
So what role do you think that pandemic fatigue has played in the boost in the number of cases?
Pandemic fatigue is a very important factor to discuss because it relates to these very basic infection prevention practices that are our very best tools right now to protect ourselves and our communities and our families. And that's the very simple acts of wearing a mask, physical distancing, and washing our hands and avoiding large gatherings indoors. So these are messages that people have heard again and again and again, and we're tired. It's been over a year now that we have been asked to do these things, and they're difficult. You really have to change your behaviors, and they interfere, of course, with certain things that we want to do. So people are tired, understandably, but I think it is important to remember that we have the vaccines on the horizon. Vaccine distribution and administration is underway, and we really need some patience and perseverance to keep up the infection prevention practices for a bit longer.
One of the questions that came up at the beginning of the pandemic, and it's still a question that people are wondering, some of the people who get infected with the coronavirus suffer either no or some mild symptoms, while others suffer from much more severe and even deadly forms of COVID-19. Other than some of the previous risk factors like being over 65, being obese, having diabetes, high blood pressure, and so on, have researchers been able to determine what causes for mild symptoms in one person while another person has much more serious symptoms?
This is one of the mysteries of this viral illness for which we will need further research and continue learning as we go forward. In general, I can point to a couple of things, though, that we do know. So in addition to those risk factors that you mentioned, so obesity and having underlying conditions like diabetes or heart disease or lung disease, which make you more vulnerable to the severe forms of the disease, we also know that the amount of virus at the beginning of your exposure can play a role in the severity of disease. And so this is one of the reasons it's important to wear a mask, because the mask is a barrier that even if it doesn't protect you completely from catching the infection, it can still limit the amount of virus that is inoculated or inhaled into your airways. And we know that breathing in a higher quantity of virus at the beginning can be correlated with more severe disease. But then there are a variety of other parts of your immune system response that may also play a role. And this is a very complex system, how your body fights off infections. And what we know is that you can have severe forms of the disease if you have too little immune response, but also if you have an overactive immune response as well, ironically.
Speaking of the immune system reacting, there's a term that they use for that.
So I believe you're probably talking about the cytokine storm, which is a term that is used for a very over-exuberant immune response. And cytokines are chemicals that the immune system or the body uses to activate the immune system and to alert it that an invader or a pathogen is present and to stimulate a fight against that invader. But when you get a storm or a flood of these chemicals, it can really lead to a very robust immune system response that causes more damage to human tissues, to your own body, in the process of trying to respond to the virus.
Let's take a break now. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Here's a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, and many streaming services such as Apple Podcasts. If you have access to the Internet, please check out our Facebook and Twitter pages at Carol Castiel, VOA, for alerts and program updates. Let's get back to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Today, we're getting an update on the COVID-19 pandemic, talking about how health professionals are handling the crisis and learning about the available and developing coronavirus vaccines that may lead to an end to this deadly scourge. My guest who joins me by Microsoft Teams is Dr. Lisa Marigakis, MD. Dr. Marigakis is the Senior Director of Infection Prevention with the Johns Hopkins Health System and an Associate Professor of Medicine at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Marigakis, let's talk a little about the treatments for COVID-19. How is it typically treated among those with mild to those with deadly symptoms? I'm sure the treatment varies with the severity.
Treatment definitely varies with severity. So one thing to know is that the vast majority of people who have COVID-19 will either have no symptoms or mild symptoms. So that is the good news, although we all have to be vigilant that even under those conditions, you can still transmit the virus to others. And that's why it's important to be very vigilant for any symptoms and to do the kind of contact tracing, quarantine, and isolation precautions, even for mild illness. But for individuals who have more severe symptoms, many of those can recover at home. One thing that we do suggest, however, is if you have access to a small device to measure your blood oxygen level, and this is just like a little sensor that can be placed on the tip of your finger, that can be very helpful to make sure that if you are short of breath and developing respiratory symptoms, that you don't reach that critical level where you need to seek a higher level of care and go to the doctor or possibly even be admitted to the hospital. And then once patients really have more severe symptoms, they might qualify for some of the therapies. Some of these now, such as monoclonal antibody, are available in limited supplies to be given to patients who don't need hospitalization, but who were recently diagnosed with COVID-19. And then for hospitalized patients, we have gotten much better over this year in knowing how to support their breathing functions, their respiratory status, and we do have therapies now that can try to work directly against the virus and also control that immune response if it gets too overactive.
Treatments that are available right now, does it help lower the impact of COVID on the body? Because I understand along with respiratory illness, it has many effects on the human body, including the brain, the heart, the muscles, whatever. Does this treatment also look out for that as well?
Absolutely. So our number one goal in treating patients who have COVID-19 is to support them, to offer what we call supportive care. And often that does require, for more severe cases, hospitalization or even intensive care unit care and mechanical ventilation for some of those patients. So you're right, many body systems can be affected, and we do have to support patients as their own immune system fights the infection. We do have some therapies as well that can work as antiviral agents, trying to really suppress the virus from being able to replicate itself. And then other therapies that are effective for those patients who have a cytokine storm or a really strong immune reaction that try to suppress that immune system response. I know that sounds a little ironic when you're fighting an infection, but we try to support the patients and make sure that their own immune response doesn't cause more damage than good.
Looking at what researchers are developing, what promising treatments are in the pipeline still to come regarding COVID-19? What are you seeing?
You know, we've talked about the different classes of medications that can be helpful, but there are also a lot of ways that we can support the patients and take care of their breathing function and support them without putting them on mechanical ventilation. So that has been one of the biggest breakthroughs, I think, is to reduce the number of patients that have to use a mechanical ventilator, because we know that in and of itself makes it harder for some patients to eventually recover and get off of the mechanical ventilation, for instance. So these are things like non-invasive ways to support breathing and increase their oxygenation without putting them on a full ventilator. Then there are research studies and candidate therapies that are also being studied. Again, I would say that the scientific advances have been really unprecedented during this pandemic response. So I would anticipate that we will see other types of therapeutics, probably in those major categories of antiviral agents that attack the virus itself, what we call immunomodulator agents that control the overactive immune response, and perhaps other therapies as well.
Dr. Mirogakis, now let's talk about an area of the pandemic that is giving people around the world some hope about an end to the pandemic, and that's the vaccines. And there have been a number of vaccines that have been developing, including those for use and those still in testing. And I understand there are four types of COVID vaccines. What are they? How do they work? And what are some of the pros and cons of each?
Well, I'll start off by saying that we are so hopeful because of the arrival of these vaccines. And it has broken all previous records to have vaccines available in such a short period of time. And I know this has seemed like the longest year, but it is really miraculous that we already have so many different vaccines that are available and being administered to people and also others on the horizon. So as you mentioned, there are different kinds of vaccines, and some of the vaccine platforms have been used for a very long period of time and for other pathogens. And so these include vaccines that are what I will call viral vector vaccines. And that means you take some other kind of virus, not the coronavirus, but a different kind of virus that does not cause disease, and you modify it so that it will actually basically instruct the person's immune system to recognize proteins of the coronavirus and to make it mount an immune response. All of the different kinds of vaccines really use different strategies in order to teach your immune system to recognize proteins from the pathogen of interest, in this case, the coronavirus. So a viral vector is one way to do that. You can also have protein subunit vaccines that are a mixture of proteins themselves with other substances that stimulate the immune system and response. But one of the most exciting and new platforms is something called messenger RNA vaccines, or mRNA. And these are two of the types of vaccine that are now under emergency use authorization in the United States and are beginning to be distributed and administered. And the messenger RNA is a relatively new platform. It's been developed over the last several years and for other pathogens and was adapted and is the first time that it is being used or authorized for a virus, in this case, the coronavirus. And what messenger RNA is a substance, it's a biological substance that instructs your own cells to make proteins. And the code for the protein is that of the spike protein of the coronavirus. And so after getting one of these vaccines, your cell machinery in the area of the vaccine starts pumping out copies of the spike protein. And that's a trigger for your immune system to respond and to make antibodies and a reaction that will then recognize any of these vaccines then are to train your immune system to recognize the virus itself and react and protect you.
In the United States, there are two vaccines that have been authorized for emergency use, as you mentioned, the Pfizer-BioNTech and Moderna. I understand they're both using the mRNA platform.
Yes, that's correct. Both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are examples of that messenger RNA, mRNA platform.
Speaking of rolling out the vaccine to throughout the world, again, the two U.S. vaccines require a lot of care in storage and transportation. Are there vaccines available that can be just taken off the shelf and used?
Yes. So you're mentioning one of the major limitations of this new vaccine platform, the messenger RNA. And that is that it is a substance that requires very, very careful handling and what we call cold chain or storage at extremely cold temperatures. And that is logistically very difficult to keep a vial of vaccine frozen at such low temperatures as it is transported from one place to another and as it is stored and then administered to individuals. So a lot of logistics challenges around the mRNA vaccines, as miraculous as they are. Thankfully, there are many of these other more traditional vaccine platforms that do not require that level of frozen storage and transportation. And so I think it will be very important that we utilize those, particularly in parts of the world that will have even more challenges maintaining that kind of a cold chain distribution channel and administration channel that I just mentioned.
And going back a little bit to the mutated versions of COVID-19, I have heard that the current vaccines are also effective against the mutated strains. If so, how do scientists know this to be true?
So the variants are causing quite a bit of concern in this regard. We, as I mentioned, are in a race really against the virus to try to control it and get everyone vaccinated before mutations emerge that will escape from our current and future vaccines and therapeutics. You're correct that right now the data that have been published are reassuring so far that our vaccines will still be effective against the variants. But ongoing research is examining this. And it's a hard question to answer because there are a variety of mutations in the different variants. We have the UK variant. Somewhat more concerning have been variants detected in South Africa and Brazil that have more mutations, and ones that are in that critical receptor binding domain of the spike protein, that lock and key that allows the virus to enter our cells. So the possibility still remains that the virus will develop mutations that may escape our vaccines. The good news about that is that we can adapt our vaccine strategy. That would take time, and it would be very unfortunate if we had to do it, but it is possible.
Speaking of immunizations, I know there are some diseases and some immunizations that require boosters after a few years. Will people who get COVID vaccines today require a booster sometime down the line?
We believe that will be very likely. We don't yet know how long the immunity will last following really either natural infection or vaccination, and it may vary from certain types of the vaccines, but it is likely, we believe, that a booster will be required at some interval. We can't yet say what that would be. The other thing to mention is that some of the vaccines require two doses, and that is another thing about the mRNA platform. Both the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines require two doses, and some of the other vaccines on the horizon are only one dose, which, of course, is logistically easier to administer.
And finally, Dr. Maragakis, with the distribution of vaccines and other findings being developed, we are finally starting to see a light at the end of the tunnel regarding the pandemic. Do you see that, or do we still have a long way to go?
I do see that. I am cautiously optimistic that the rollout of the vaccines, the availability of them will increase, and that we will begin to get a handle on this in the coming months and see the end of the pandemic. I would caution, however, that we must move as rapidly as we can to vaccinate as many people as we can in the coming weeks and months. And for all the reasons we've discussed today, there are some challenges with that. And I would say that as tired as we all are, that we really need patience and perseverance with infection prevention precautions along the way so that we can use every means at our disposal to get control of the viral transmission, preserve our healthcare resources, and save lives.
One of the people who are at the forefront of the science behind COVID-19 and the science behind prevention is Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. I remember reading he had said that perhaps by fall, people can go back to church and start singing together again. That sounds very optimistic. Do you share his thoughts?
Well, wouldn't that be wonderful? I certainly hope that he is right. I have so much respect for Dr. Fauci, and I would say that that is a wonderful goal, and we are working very hard every day to move as quickly as possible to try to achieve that goal. So I hope so.
Dr. Maragakis, thank you so much for the work that you and your colleagues have been doing to fight this terrible pandemic. And I want to thank you very much for taking time from your schedule to talk to us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. Lisa Maragakis, MD. She's the Senior Director of Infection Prevention with the Johns Hopkins Health System and an Associate Professor of Medicine at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. She joined our program today via Microsoft Teams. This is Rick Pantaleo. Thanks for listening today, and be sure to join Carol Castiel again next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.